This is program number 7 of the Does God Exist audio series. John Clayton is your speaker. Before we talk about how we are in the image of God, let's review for just a minute what we did in the last presentation. The last presentation, we talked about the nature of God. What is God? Not who is God, what is God? We tried to point out that the biblical description of God is that God is not a physical entity. He's not a physical being. We read things like God is love, 1 John 4 and verse 8. God is light, 1 John 1 and verse 5. God is a spirit, and they that worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth, John 4:24. Blessed art thou, Simon Bar-Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed it unto thee, but my Father who art in heaven, Matthew 16, verse 17. God is not a man, Numbers 23 and verse 1. All of these descriptions of God portray to us God in a sense that God is not a human entity. There is no anthropomorphism, in other words, making God in our own image. We also talked about the concept of God being in a different dimension than we are, and we looked at passages like 2 Peter 3 and verse 8. It talks about how a day is unto the Lord as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is one day. We talked about Jeremiah 23:23, where God talks about the fact that he is in all points of space now. So when Acts 17, beginning with verse 22, says, in him we live and move and have our being, in verse 28, it's saying something we can understand. If we understand God to not be a physical being. But that raises another question. If that is the case, then what does the Bible mean when it says in Genesis 1:27, so God created man in his own image? In the image of God created he him, male and female created he them. What does that mean? Now let me just pound on this one little bit further. What it cannot mean is that we look like God. And what I always like people to visualize, if I showed you a picture of me, and then I showed you a different picture of me, what would be true of the two pictures? Well, they should be pretty much alike. They should have the same physical makeup. If they're portraits, they should look pretty much the same. And why is that? Well, that's because the photographs were made in my image. Now, if you think about that for a minute, if I am in the image of God, and if you are in the image of God, and if that is a physical image of a physical God, then what would have to be true of you and me? Well, we would have to be identical twins, wouldn't we? As a matter of fact, every human on the planet would look exactly alike if we were in the physical image of God. So that clearly is not what the Bible is talking about. One way of getting a handle on this is to understand that in the original language of the Bible, there are different words used to describe God. The word Elohim is used almost exclusively in the first chapter of Genesis. But the word Yahweh is used in the second chapter of Genesis. Adonai is used in the 15th chapter of Genesis. And each of those words conveys a different attribute of God. Elohim was used when the Jews were trying to convey the power and the strength and the majesty of God. Yahweh was used when they were emphasizing the promises of God. Adonai was used when they were emphasizing the ruler aspect or the ruler concept of God. And actually, Adonai is only used 8 times in all of Genesis, so Elohim and Yahweh are the ones that are used the most commonly. Yahweh is used some 6,000 times in the Old Testament. But Elohim is used 200 times in Genesis and exclusively in the first chapter. And that makes sense because it is the power and the strength and the majesty of God that is being described. But here's what's interesting. Those words are plural words. The word Elohim is plural. There is a singular word for God, El, but El, but it's not used until the 14th chapter of Genesis in the 18th verse. Elohim is used exclusively in the first chapter, and it is a plural word. Now you say, well, what do you mean plural? You're talking about more than one God? No, the concept of God in the Bible is monotheistic from its origin. But as you read through the Bible, you find that there are clear indications as to what this is describing. In Matthew 28 and verse 19, we're familiar with the passage. It says, "Go, therefore, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit." In Colossians, Jesus indicates he was there at the beginning. John 1:1 gives a similar indication. We know that the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters in Genesis. There are three different aspects of God that are described in the Genesis account and throughout the Bible. We sometimes hear the word Trinity applied to that. That's not in the Bible, but the word Godhead is. We ought not to think that the Godhead is likened unto gold or silver or stone crafted by art and man's device in Acts 17, mentioned earlier. You say, well, that sounds pretty complicated. I mean, that's difficult. I have trouble understanding that. Well, let me give you a simple way to get at least somewhat of a handle on that. You are three separate autonomous entities, just as God does, but there's only one of you. So just as God is three, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, you are three. You have intellect, you have personality, and you have a spiritual makeup, which we refer to as the soul. Let's talk about your intellect. Now, don't mix the word intellect up with intelligence. You can accuse me of not being intelligent, but you cannot accuse me of not having intellect. Intellect is that capacity of man which enables man to function without the benefit of instinct. An animal reacts to the here and now. It doesn't deal with the past. It doesn't get bent out of shape about the future. It deals with the immediate situation. You want to get a psychologist in an argument? Ask him how many instincts man is born with in the presence of another psychologist. I can almost guarantee you an argument because I'm not even sure we can understand what the word means in many cases. But the point here is that humans are not driven by instinct. We have intellect. We have the capacity to choose to do things that are not instinctive in nature. For instance, man creates art. It's kind of interesting to look at the cave paintings that have been discovered throughout the old world. Beautiful paintings on the walls of caves, paintings of animals, paintings of sometimes spirit creatures, pottery works. Picasso went into one of those caves and came out and said, "We have learned nothing about art in our entire history." And the point is that these paintings and drawings are as good as anything man can do today. Remember all those art appreciation classes that you took? You learned about structure and abstraction and form. All of these paintings show these tremendous abilities artistically. What is it in man that gives him this ability to create beautiful works of art? What is it in man that has caused him from his very earliest days to express himself in music? Have you ever heard a chimpanzee writing a protest song? What is it in man that gives him this ability? What happens when you give a chimpanzee a crayon or a paintbrush? He eats it. That's what happens. He doesn't sit down and express himself artistically. What is it in man that has caused him from his very earliest days to express himself in worship? Why does man worship God anyway? The famous atheist Bertrand Russell said one time, "The center of me is always and eternally a terrible pain. A curious, wild pain, a searching for something beyond what the world holds, something transfigured and infinite, the beatific vision God." He went on to say, "I do not find it, I do not think it is to be found, but the love of it is my life. It's like the passionate love for a ghost. It fills every passion I have. It is the actual spring of life in me." So even the atheist recognizes there is an intrinsic, basic makeup in man that gives him the capacity to create art, to create music, to worship God. And somebody says, "Well, we did that because we're so smart." I'm sorry, but I can blow a 15-foot hole in that argument. I have a mentally retarded son by the name of Tim. My son Tim has a Stanford-Binet IQ of about 45. The best he's ever scored on any IQ test was a 52, and on the ones that I'm going to make reference to a little bit later, he scores in the 40s. So my son Tim does not have much intelligence. But if you were to visit our home and eat a meal with us and Tim was there, he would lead us in prayer at the dinner table. He's unquestionably the most spiritual of my three children. You gift him a crayon and a piece of paper, and before he lost his eyesight, he'd draw you a beautiful picture. He was very good artistically. You listened to Tim when he was playing out in the yard as a child. You'd hear him making up songs, expressing what had happened to him during the day in music. What is it in man that gives him this ability? It's not intelligence. People we have written off as vegetables do the things about which I'm talking, and smart animals do not. And somebody says, well, it's not just intelligence, it's also environment. You know, we have the old nurture-nature thing. In 1976, there was a gorilla by the name of Coco made the news. Coco had learned the sign language of the deaf. And Penny Patterson, his trainer, was making all kinds of interesting claims about what Coco could do. As a matter of fact, one of the claims was that he expressed himself in art. And there was even a painting that was circulated that Coco supposedly drew. What happened was that Miss Patterson sat down and showed him how to use a paintbrush. And she put a canvas in front of him. He took a paintbrush, which had been dipped in yellow paint, and he streaked the canvas a few times. And she signed banana to him in the sign language of the deaf. And Coco signed banana back, indicating that he understood that he had painted a banana, according to her. 3 weeks later, she held up the canvas in front of the gorilla. He looked at the canvas and signed banana. So her claim is that he had created art, created a picture of a banana. The problem with that is when someone walked into the gorilla's cage wearing a yellow smile button, the gorilla would point to the button and sign banana. When someone walked in wearing a yellow hat, he would point to the hat and sign banana. And there was an article in National Geographic about Miss Patterson giving the gorilla a yellow kitten. What would you guess the gorilla signed when he saw the yellow kitten? I have to tell you this story. I was doing a lectureship one time and made this comment, and there was a junior high kid jumped up in the back, and when he saw the gorilla grabbing the kitten, he hollered, "Lunch!" No, not lunch. The gorilla signed banana. And the important thing to understand here is that this is just a case of good old-fashioned Pavlovian conditioning. The gorilla is reacting to the color. And Thorndike has shown that when pigeons are given the same amount of training that's been given to the talking chimps, they can do much of what the talking chimps can do. It's not just the creativity in man that suggests to us that there is a spiritual dimension to man. There's also what I'm calling personality. Let's suppose you get home and you find that your dog has chewed up your favorite pair of slippers. And you roll up a newspaper and you raise your hand as if you're going to whack the dog. And the dog cowers. What's going on? Is the dog overwhelmed with some compelling sense of guilt? I suggest to you he's learned that behavior. He's learned you don't hit him so hard if he looks pathetic enough. That's a conditioned response. There's no evidence your dog feels guilty when he bites the postman. No evidence he has any sympathy for the cat he runs up the tree next door for the 35th time. I can tell you about animal forgiveness. My daughter's had a cat one time that I had a little run-in with when he got it. I had to pull him out of a cage, and he didn't want to come out of the cage, and so I sort of jerked him out and handed him to my daughter, and he became her pet. We had that cat for, I think, 8 years. And 8 years later, every time he would see me, he would hiss. Animals don't forgive. I've seen people like that, too, but that's another matter. They are deliberately choosing that. What I'm suggesting to you is when we say that man is created in the image of God, we're not talking about man's physical makeup. We're talking about man's spiritual makeup. We are spiritually in God's image. Romans 8 and verse 16 says, "The Spirit itself beareth witness with our spirit that we are children of God." Our soul is what is created in the image of God. Your soul is not some kind of physical apparition that floats out of your body when you die. Your soul is that part of you which gives you the capacity to create, to feel guilt, to be sympathetic. And it's so important to understand that this makes you of intrinsic worth. We are all identical twins spiritually. And if I believe that, then no matter who you are, no matter what your race, no matter what your sex, no matter what your intelligence, no matter what your money, no matter what your education, no matter even what you've done, you have intrinsic inherent value because you were uniquely and specially created in the image of God. That, and that alone, makes you of intrinsic worth. So from a biblical perspective, every human has incredible value. Now, if you were to look at a physical anthropology definition of man, you would see it's quite different. My anthropology book lists some 15 characteristics that define man. The statement is, man is that animal that has. And then there's 15 criteria. Cranial capacity of 900 to 2300 cc's. 50% more nerve cells in the visual center. A rounded skull with a vertical forehead. Lack of a muscle ridge, vertical foramen magnum, 2-1-2-3 tooth pattern, and so forth. As you listen to those, do you see the difference between those and the ones that I had listed from a biblical perspective? These are things that describe man's physical makeup, his skeleton. The things that an anthropologist might find while excavating an area where ancient man lived. And this is not to be critical of that. That's the only way that that particular discipline can function. But it's important to understand that the definition is very different. Would it not be possible for an individual to have all 15 criteria that qualify the individual as human from an anthropological standpoint and yet still not be in the image of God? Would it not be possible also for someone to be in the image of God and have none of those characteristics? You see, the point is here that the definitions are very, very different. And so when you see caveman pictures and models and things of this type, what you're looking at is a definition which fits the physical criteria of what someone might find while digging fossils in a cave somewhere in the old world. I do think it makes a difference, however, how you define man. If man is just an animal, if the only thing that distinguishes us from animals is the size of our brain and the position of our thumb, and all these other physical criteria, if man's past is strictly an animal past, then as Carl Sagan used to like to say, we are nothing special. We are nothing special. And if we are nothing special, then I suggest to you everything Adolf Hitler did makes some sense. Nietzsche, who was used by the Germans to justify much of what they did, said one time, there is no reason why the stronger and smarter should continue to be constrained by a value, which he had in quotes, that is obviously not in their interest. It's important to understand that if I think you are created in the image of God, then I am constrained to believe you have purpose, you have value, you have worth. If, on the other hand, you are an animal, and the only thing that distinguishes you from a dog is the way the environment has worked on the mutations that occurred in your ancestors, then man has no particular value. And this is a huge difference. It's important to understand that believing that man is created in the image of God gives all human beings worth and value. And I suggest to you that it is much easier, if your definition simply involves man's physical characteristics, to write man off. Peter Singer, who is the head of the ethics department at Harvard University at the time I am speaking, has taken that position, and he has suggested that the way to solve many of our social ills is to simply euthanize the mentally retarded. Simply euthanize the mentally ill. And his argument is primarily evolutionary, maintaining that the amount of money and time and energy that is spent on the unfit could be better spent improving the life and capacity to enjoy life of those who are fit. I see this on so many different levels. Let me tell you a story that happened to me in my teaching experience. When I started teaching at Riley High School in 1959, one of the things I realized was that a lot of these inner city kids just needed somebody to help them, to tutor them. So I started running tutoring sessions in my room at 6 o'clock in the morning. Kids could come in and I would tutor them in math or physics or chemistry or science or whatever they were taking that was in the area of sciences that I knew something about. So I got to know some kids who came in regularly, but usually in the middle of the year and right before Christmas, there was no one there. And this event happened right before the Christmas break. I came to my room that morning and the door was unlocked. And that was unusual. The school had a lot of violence at that time. There was gang activity going on. We weren't supposed to go into a room that was unlocked, but it was 6 o'clock and security didn't come on until 7 something, and I didn't want to sit around and wait. So against probably the better judgment, I went in my room and turned on the light. And there was a young lady sitting in the first seat, one of my students, and she was holding a gun pointed right at my head. But before I could blink, she said, "Don't worry, Mr. Clayton, this is not for you," and she put the gun in her mouth. We've been trained in what to do, so I did what the book says I should do. I backed up, and I said to her, her name was Heather, I said, "Heather, I don't understand. What are you doing? What's going on? Heather." She said, "I'm nothing special. I'm nothing special. And all that ever happens to me with men is bad stuff. And I don't want to live in a crummy world like this. And there's nothing you can say that's going to change my mind." And she put the gun back in her mouth. And I said, "Heather, wait a minute. Wait. Heather, I don't understand." I said, "Heather, you're a beautiful woman. You're gorgeous. You have an incredible mind. You're one of my best students in AP Physics. I don't know anybody in the school that's ever said anything bad about you. Teachers or kids. Heather, you're not making sense. What's going on?" She lowered the gun. She said, "All right, I'll tell you what's going on." She says, "You know what happened. My parents got divorced in August." And I said, "Oh, yeah, Heather, but lots of kids go through." She waved me off. She said, "Last night when I came home, my mother's boyfriend raped me." And I said, "Oh, man. Oh, Heather. Oh, that's terrible, Heather. But she..." And then she waved me off again. She said, "So I ran to my dad's house, and you know what he did?" And she turned her head, and the left side of her face was cut and bruised from her father's fist. She said, "He says it's my fault. I don't want to live in a world like this. I don't want to be in a place like this." And she put the gun back in her mouth. I dropped to my knees, and I said to her, "Heather, listen to me." Said, "Heather, you're beautiful." "No, I'm not." "Heather, you're beautiful." "No, I'm not." We did that quite a few times. "Heather, you're beautiful because you're created in the image of God. That makes you special." I said, "Heather, you've just gone through the most horrible experience a human being can endure. And you're in no condition to make a decision about life and death right now. But I'm going to stay right here on the floor," because at this point I was on my knees on the floor. "I just want you to hear me. You're beautiful, you're special, because you're created in the image of God. And that gives you intrinsic inherent worth, and nobody can take that away from you." I said, "Heather, maybe something good can come out of this. Maybe this experience will help you decide on a career. Maybe it'll help you find God. But Heather, please." At this point, I'm begging her, and I would beg any woman that's gone through an experience like this, any man that's been through something like this, please, please don't pull the trigger. Now, you know, and I know, that she was there that morning because she really did not want to pull the trigger. If she wants to blow herself away, she doesn't have to come to school and do it, does she? She's looking for answers. She didn't pull the trigger. It's a long story, but a year and a half later, I sat in her box at commencement. I was the only person she invited. And I watched her graduate from high school. She went to a major university. She's majored in psychology. She's working with battered and abused women and children. Her life is different. And she's become a Christian. Because she's seen the value of that lifestyle and that value of what a human is worth. And I tell you that story to say to you, this is not just a fun and games battle of semantics. This is a fundamental issue. What kind of a world do you want to live in? What kind of a world do you want to leave to your kids, to your grandkids? A world in which every human being is treated with dignity and respect because they have intrinsic inherent worth, no matter what their condition is, no matter where they are in life, because they are created in the image of God. Or do we want to build the super society at the expense of the individual? I'm here to say to you, you are a human being, created in the image of God. You have an eternal soul that can live forever and never die. Do you believe that? Are you really willing to believe that you're nothing more than a mechanical accident? That there is nothing that distinguishes you except the size of your brain or your history genetically? If you believe that you are created in the image of God, that you have an eternal soul that can live forever and never die, I submit to you there is nothing you could do that would be any more logical or any more reasonable than to make sure that eternal soul of yours is in a saved relationship with the God who created it. And as we continue to discuss the issues of the existence of God and our nature as beings created in the image of God and the validity of the Christian system, one of the most fundamental concepts that I hope you will keep in your head is that you are of value. You are spiritually in God's image.